This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The 2015 session of the Kentucky General Assembly wrapped up Tuesday night in a burst of last-minute activity that resulted in the passage of several bills, including legislation to address the state's heroin problem. Now, joining us to review that bill and other key legislation passed in this session of the General Assembly are State Representative Dennis Keene, Ray Hodge, editor of the Oldham Era newspaper, and James Pilcher, Northern Kentucky reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. And good afternoon, everybody. Good to have you with us.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Thank you.
Now, we won't be able to take phone calls during this segment, but if you'd like to send us a question or a comment, you can still email us, talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And, Ray, what was the most significant piece of legislation that came out of this whole session?
I think we can all agree, and pretty much anyone in the Kentucky press you talk to or anyone in Northern Kentucky would definitely be able to tell you that the passage of heroin legislation or bills that are aimed at stopping the tide of heroin in Kentucky, definitely the most significant piece of legislation this year. Had we not managed to get something done in the Kentucky legislature, very likely would have seen some torches and pitchforks show up. There was a lot of vocal civic participation this year on the issue.
Now, James, I think the last time we talked about the heroin bill, if I remember correctly, there was a balancing act going on between either doing tougher enforcement or more rehabilitation or some combination of that. So how did this particular bill turn out? Does it lean one way or the other?
Actually, it has some of both. It has $10 million immediately to be infused towards treatment and education programs. And then starting in the next budget cycle, $24 million a year for those same kinds of programs. It kind of leaves it up to the discretion of the Justice Secretary to determine where that money goes. But a lot of it's going to go towards expanding treatment beds that are overseen by health departments. And it also, more money towards babies born addicted or getting pregnant mothers off drugs before they have their babies. That was a big fee. And then there is money in there. There is allocations in there for money to go to prison programs so when somebody's arrested or convicted, they can get off while they're in jail so they don't get them come out and start using again. On the flip side, the penalty phases did get somewhat tougher. That was a big sticking point between the House Democrats and the Senate Republicans, and there was some compromise there because the House Democrats didn't want anybody with a low-level amount that might be selling just to support their habit to be treated like a high-level dealer. But there was some compromise there, and even the amount that you get caught with to be considered really the worst of the worst got lowered to 100 grams. So if you're caught with 100 grams of heroin, you're a class B felon and you go away to jail for a long time.
Dennis?
James is absolutely right. SB 192 actually created a new crime. It's punishable by up to 10 years in prison, and that is specifically aimed at those who are importing heroin into Kentucky
right.
with an intent to distribute or sell. I believe it's aggravated trafficking. And these are specifically targeting areas very much like Representative Keene's area, like Wilder and like Covington and like Newport, where we're seeing an influx really just starting to hit the state from that area. It also set up something that was an instrumental kind of compromise between the two parties. One of the major sticking points, all puns aside, was a needle exchange program. While many House Democrats wanted to see something in there, in the bill, to stop the enormous infection rates of HIV and hepatitis C that are a side effect of heroin abuse and needle abuse, many Republicans in the Senate had a hesitant approach to that or altogether shut it out. And, you know, not to brag on Representative Keene too hard here, but he really was instrumental in allowing that compromise to happen with a local option, something that puts control of a needle exchange program in small areas, small counties, and small communities.
Dennis, you wanted to weigh in on this?
And that was one of the things, sticking points that we had, was to make sure that we gave local option and gave those communities the opportunity to participate in this program. And I think that's what it made it a little bit easier for my Republican colleagues to go along with, because we were putting local control and letting them deal with that. The other thing, James, that you were talking about earlier about with the laws getting stricter, what we found the focus groups that we worked with, we found that in Kentucky's laws were, in fact, more harsh than the five states around us. The problem was is that our parole was putting them out in about 22% of the time served, and that's what the big problem was, and that's where some of this changed, where we went to mandating that they would have to do 50% of their sentence.
Dennis, how much of an impact do you think that this is going to have on the heroin problem in Kentucky?
Well, I think it'll make a big difference. It shows us being a little bit tougher on crime and keeps those individuals in where they should be, in prison. Now, that doesn't mean that that's going to stop. They'll still come out, and they'll be where when you lock up one dealer, another one sprouts up, or two even. But it does make it a little bit more difficult for them to do business, and that was one of the big things that we need to do.
James, there was another drug-related bill that was passed during this session. What was that one about?
That was the, are you referring to the naloxone?
Yes, I think that's correct. It's an ingredient in an over-the-counter medication?
Naloxone is actually an
anti-overdose medication.
Okay, heroin. That's on heroin. There was something else they passed that concerned over-the-counter medication. I think it was trying to curtail a certain type of abuse of this medication.
Not familiar with that one, Mark. I apologize. I was really focused in on the heroin.
Okay. Was that like
is that something you know about?
Like naloxone or something like that?
I stumped everybody.
The naloxone element of the heroin legislation may be what you're referring to. And it can be very confusing for anyone just taking a first glimpse, because I'm sure, as Representative Keene remembers, at one point we had not one, two, or three, but five bills related to heroin circulating through our legislature at any given point. And what ended up happening is some of the provisions of some of those bills ended up in the final passage of one, particularly the naloxone component, which focuses on taking something that's normally a hard-to-get prescription anti-overdose medication. Basically, it targets the opioid receptors in the brain, and it shuts down overdose. So it saves lives. And essentially, it was a crucial element to get in the bill that first responders, EMS, police officers, and even family members were able to get a hold of this life-saving medication and be equipped with it. And that became a good bipartisan component to the bill itself.
Yeah, there is a drug.
Go ahead, Dennis.
There's a drug that we found out in research that's being used in Ohio. It's called Vivitrol, and it's been called a miracle drug. As far as, you can take a shot of that once a month. It costs about $800, and it blocks those brain cells that makes the desire for heroin. So we're hoping to spread that into Kentucky also.
Another big aspect that people focused on the penalties and the needle exchange. But another big aspect of this, it did take some compromises, called the Good Samaritan Clause. And there's a lot of hope that actually will help catch people who've overdosed before they die. Basically, it gives anybody who calls in amnesty from any criminal charges, as long as they give their name and address, when they call in if their friend is overdosed. So the police and the EMTs show up, and if you're high and you maybe have a little bit of heroin, but if you called in, for your friend who's OD'd, you're not going to face prosecution because you did that. Now, if they go in and they find a full den, a heroin dealer, that's a whole different story. But that was there was some discussion of whether or not it should be allowed once, whether or not it should be left up to the prosecutor's discretion as to whether to prosecute. But in the end, they decided to just go ahead and make it a full amnesty. And they're really trying to get the word out on that now, so when people don't feel the danger of getting in trouble or getting their friend in trouble if there is an overdose situation.
I can talk about that on a personal level. I happened to be at middle of the day one day in a gas station getting gas, and these four gentlemen pulled up in a work van, and three of them got out and walked into the store to get something, and the one guy that was with him, he stumbled and sat down on the sidewalk, and I just wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to him, but my son-in-law was, and the three gentlemen came out, and they looked at him, and they got in the van, and they left him. And my son-in-law kept on watching him. He said, Mr. Keeney said, I think that that guy's overdosed. We went over there, and sure enough, he was almost dead to the world. We called 911, and they got there and got him revived. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing the Good Samaritan would do. I mean, instead of leaving that guy to die, you would have a chance to stay there with him, call the necessary people, and save his life. And that was very important.
Now, Dennis, you you sponsored the ignition interlock legislation that passed during this session. Tell me how that's going to work.
Well, that's been something of great pride for me. I've worked on that. I filed that bill 6 years, and this is the first year we actually got it completed. How it works, as you know the story, my daughter was hit by a drunk driver back in 2002 on the week of her high school graduation, and I got that call, as many people do.
That's an awful phone call.
Oh, it's a horrible phone call, and you don't want to put anybody through that. And we got to the hospital, and after about three operations and a year of therapy, we got her back on her feet. But what really drove me to start looking at ways to solve this problem. And I found out there was a mechanical device called an interlock that goes on the car and causes a person to blow in. If their alcohol content is a certain grade, the car will not start. Also, and you know, people will say, well, what about if they had a passenger and they blew into it? Well, in about 5 minutes after you start the car, it asks you to retest. Plus, it has a camera taking pictures of who is actually blowing into that machine. And that's a record that the judge would be able to look at to see how you're recovering from your offense.
Are these devices a proven lifesaver, Dennis?
Yes, they are.
What kind of experience have people? I mean, what's the background on that?
Well,
wide
it,
use of these and
the 24 states that have interlock systems experience about a 40% reduction in drunk driving deaths, fatalities. To give you some kind of idea, in Kentucky in 2013, we had 165 fatalities due to drunk driving. So that would save 40% of that. And to imagine what that would do to a family and to, you know, these loved ones are just, it's not somebody gets up and decides to kill somebody. It's just that they make poor decisions, and those poor decisions kill people.
Now, does the
Mark, if I could interject,
yeah.
I did some research for this. I wrote about this a couple times. And the other thing that I found is that if you talk to, like, Mothers Against Drunk Driving and some of these other advocacy groups, 70 to 80% of the people who cause crashes while drunk, it's like their third or fourth time. The repeat rate on drunk driving is really high. So what you do is you basically eliminate their ability to get drunk and drive again by doing this, but you also allow them to keep driving and keep going to work, so without getting their license suspended. So it's kind of a win-win for a lot of people. But again, that stat that what stood out to me is like 80% of all crashes or fatal crashes are drunk driving related or caused by a drunk driver who's been convicted before.
Dennis,
so it kind of gets that repeat driver off the road.
Does the offender pay for this and for the device, and how long do they have to keep it on the car?
The offender does pay for it. It's at no cost to the taxpayers, and there's also an indigent fund fee that the suppliers put forth for those that couldn't afford the fee. But it's left up to the court system.
Ray, the Kentucky Employee Retirement System has been a cause of concern for a number of years. Did the General Assembly do anything to help shore up the system during this session?
You know, in 2013, everyone kind of had a big hoorah moment when the Senate passed a law that would help basically bring our funding levels up on a yearly basis for the Kentucky state employees that are retiring. Now, as you know, and as I'm sure plenty of people around the country even know, we've got one of the worst pension systems for our public employees. Well, it's not just the state employees. In fact, it's also the teachers' employees. And one of the big things that was hoped for this year, which went over and was really, frankly, it's been described as a missed opportunity for the legislature this session, was the passage of a bill or a law which would assist in funding the $14 billion liability for teachers' retirement systems. Now, unlike a lot of other states, Kentucky teachers don't actually receive Social Security when they retire. And, in fact, they're not qualified or they're not allowed to get their spouse's Social Security should their spouse pass away. So they're really in a pinch in this. When I spoke to the KEA folks here, the Kentucky Educators Association, one of the things they told me was 50% of Kentucky public school teachers are currently eligible for retirement. So in order to pay out those things, if even a chunk of those started retiring this year, they unfortunately wouldn't have enough to make payroll. They're currently liquidating their assets. One proposal that went through was a $3.3 billion bonding bill. It was proposed by House Speaker Stumbo, and it would have essentially taken the high interest rate that we have now, and it would have transferred it over by allowing the state to issue $3.3 billion worth of bonds toward this. And so that bill did not get passage. It did not pass in its form, and so we're still hearing from a lot of public school teachers right now about the retirement options that are not there, and that there's a lot of growing concern for this. Hopefully, and we've heard from a couple of legislators so far, that the teacher retirement system will be priority next year. So we'll look forward to seeing at least some movement on that.
I'm sure that'll happen. We passed it in the House, and I'm sure my colleagues, it'll be election year for a lot of senators next year, so I'm sure there'll be a new attitude towards that problem.
James, did you want to weigh in too?
I spoke to Speaker Stumbo yesterday, just kind of recapping the session. And honestly, he says, given the complexity of all of the different numbers that are being thrown around, he felt it was one of his proudest accomplishments of the session just to get it through the House and educate people. And he felt like a lot of senators had their eyes open to the possibility here. But I agree with Ray that there was a thinking that it was a missed opportunity, because those pension bonds that they're discussing may not be at the same low interest rates next year as they are right now. He was looking to take advantage of the market while the market was good and save the state some money. Whether or not – then there's the philosophical problem or challenge for a lot of folks, especially on the conservative side, who say, I don't want to borrow money to pay money. So there's that philosophical difference that they're going to have to overcome if they want to continue down this path next year.
James, what happened with the bill to reconfigure the Kenton County Airport Board? Because I know last time we talked, it looked like the bill was dead, and then all of a sudden it's revived. What happened?
Well, Senator John Schickel attached it to basically an innocuous House bill that had already passed and come over to the Senate, which actually was aviation related, of all things. It makes it a state law. You can't point a laser pointer at an aircraft. It passed there, and it got installed in the House primarily because of politics. Arnold Simpson had put in a word with House leaders to say he really didn't like it. And Representative Simpson represents Covington and Kenton County. His feeling was Kenton County wasn't getting any compensation for giving up control of the airport, which it does own. So it did pass the Senate. And then in the House, they added another provision that made Simpson happy, which is that now the new board, anybody that's appointed by one of the surrounding counties, Boone County gets 2 seats, while Campbell and Grant County each get a seat now on the board, while Kenton County gets 8. Kenton County Fiscal Court gets final approval of those. So even though it might only be ceremonial, it was just another way to acknowledge that Kenton County does have full control of the airport. So starting in August 1st or starting this summer, the airport board will be completely refigured. It'll have 13 members instead of 7. It'll be broader representation. Although Ohio doesn't have direct representation, Kenton County is supposed to take recommendations on an appointment from Cincinnati and Ohio, although those people need to live in Kentucky. So it is reality. It did pass. It went through a convoluted path, but it did go through.
Dennis, what do you think of this bill? Is it going to have a positive impact on the airport?
You know, I really don't know what kind of impact it'll have on the airport. It just sounds like, it still remains in Kent County's hands. And I think it's the airport is a tremendous economic engine for our region, and it affects Ohio, Indiana, and ourselves. And we really have to look at a way of changing that and get a new thought process of how we get more direct flights, international flights, because that's what's killing our businesses in the 3-state area.
Ray, one of the things that was noticeably absent from this General Assembly session was a smoking ban. So what's up with that?
You know, if you're in Covington, smoke 'em if you got 'em is the motto.
The motto of the day.
You got it. So basically, we had a poll that came out relatively close to the upcoming session, and it was a 60-plus, I think, percent approval rating from Kentuckians saying they wanted a smoking ban. this went uphill in a great trajectory with Susan Westrom, who had been representing Lexington, and she'd been pushing for this bill for a good solid 6 years. It had gotten its committee hearing, and even during the committee hearing, Representative Tom Burch, who sits over the committee, I remember him saying explicitly, you know, if you'd have heard this bill 20 years ago, you would have seen legislators light up cigarettes in protest. They just weren't going to have it. Now, despite it actually having a lot more momentum this year in the House and getting a full vote out of it, it's still fizzled, and we knew kind of early on that it was likely to fizzle. It was kind of laid at the feet of Republicans in the Senate, who tend to err on the side of free enterprise when it comes to whether or not smoking regulations we put in place. When I interviewed President of the Senate, Robert Stivers, he's a Manchester Republican. His own home county of Clay actually has about a 40% smoking rate. So it's very, very high in his area. And his, you know, his argument, of course, was that it interferes with businesses, it interferes with free enterprise, and we don't want to put our hands on that. Of course, then there was plenty of argument that came out of editorials out of Westrom's home county of, you know, Fayette. The Herald Leader editorial recently, you know, chastising the Senate, saying that, you know, free enterprise and free business aren't going to set up shop in counties that have poor health rates. And this, of course, comes on the heels of Time's own data. Time magazine itself saying that, you know, parts of Kentucky, eastern Kentucky, have some of the worst smoking rates in the entire state. So we don't know if we'll see it again next year, but that's kind of where it ended up this year.
Well, Dennis, Ray, and James, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
State Representative Dennis Keene, Ray Hodge, who's editor of the Oldham Era newspaper, and James Pilcher, the Northern Kentucky reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday, next on 91.7 WVXU.